Working Cows Podcast, Episode 63.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Merry Christmas, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, here with another episode for you guys, brought to you by the Global Ag Network. Got an episode for you today with Aaron Berger of University of Nebraska Extension. Aaron is a guy that I've had on a couple of times, great guy, operator of the, or producer of the University of Nebraska Lincoln Beef Watch Podcast, frequent contributor to the University of Nebraska Lincoln Beef Watch newsletter, and that's why I'm having him on today to discuss issues related to one of his recent articles in the University of Nebraska Lincoln Beef Watch newsletter on leasing herds and leasing land. And we're going to talk with him about some of the things that are related to that. And there will be links to Aaron's podcast and Aaron's article and the Beef Watch newsletter and podcast in general up at workingcows.net/63. Before we get to Aaron, though, I do want you to know that if you found yourself sitting around wondering how you could bless your humble podcast host this season, that after my interview with Aaron, I will let you in on one of the ways that you could do that and give you an example of some feedback I got about just how amazing this audience is. So stick around for that if you're curious. So it's a little late this week, but here we are with Aaron Berger of University of Nebraska Extension, a beef educator. Aaron, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
I appreciate the opportunity, Clay.
I invited you on to talk a little bit about leasing herds and land and the opportunities and the challenges that are presented there with that method of ranching, I guess, as a whole. And so I would just like to start off with talking a little bit about the advantages of it, why somebody would look at doing it, and how they would get started.
So I guess first, Clay, maybe let's lay a foundation and talk about land leasing and why I think we're going to see that continue to increase as we go forward in the ranching industry. I think when we look at today just at the value of land, if you're going to go buy land, it's a pretty large capital investment, especially when you're thinking about the cow portion and what amount of investment it takes to run a cow these days. And if you'll look at land listings, we're probably in the West somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 investment in land to run a cow for a year. And that's pretty challenging in my mind. We're probably in many cases looking at around 500 cows to support a family for a year, if I kind of use those numbers. So when you're looking at that kind of investment to run a cow herd, unless that land has been inherited, it becomes pretty challenging, I think, to go out and ask the land to ask the cows anyway, to make a payment towards that land and have that be very workable. I'm not saying land's not a good investment. I hope that's not what I'm communicating. I think you have to be able to capture other values from that land. And historically, when we look at land investments, really the return to that has been an appreciation over time. But the challenge is if appreciation doesn't make payments. And so that's part of the challenge. And if you're borrowing very much money and trying also to make that work with borrowing money on cattle, it becomes pretty challenging. The other thing I see is that I see a lot of outside investors continuing to see land as a safe place to put some money to diversify a portfolio. There's what I would call the John Wayne effect. There's a lot of folks who have made money in other businesses and see the desire to own some land because of its recreational value, because of its I would say it's something they can see, smell, touch, feel, walk on, have an experience with. And there's still some nostalgia, I believe, of owning a ranch. And so those things are really driving that thing. The other thing I would say is that we can increasingly see wealth being transferred to the next generation, and that next generation frequently wants to hold on to the land. There's still some tie to that historically. This has been in the family. We don't want to sell it. But I would see increasingly we're seeing land operation being separated from land ownership, being the people who are working the land, caring for the land intimately on a day-to-day basis is frequently different than the people that own it. Some thoughts, I guess, for people who are out there wanting to lease land. I think first it's really important to understand that often the landlords you work with may not have a very good understanding of ag. And so being able to communicate clearly with them is important. Part of that being able to communicate clearly in my mind is first really going in with an open mind, recognizing that the values and goals that people have for those who own the land may be very different than it would be if it was yours. And so understanding that, trying to understand what they want, what are the values they want to see, and then with that, trying to develop a management plan that you can go present to them that will communicate your desire to meet those goals and to provide an experience or provide the values that they're looking for. That might be recreation in the form of hunting. It might be a quiet place for them, a place for them to get away a couple of weeks a year. As for some people, they still want to have an experience. They want to come out and fix fence or have an experience with some cattle as part of that ownership. It's really varied in my mind in terms of what landowners want. And so being able to do that in terms of meeting those goals for that landowner is going to be really important. And I think also give you an opportunity as you think about leasing land.
So the advantage here is the lack of upfront capital investment. Is that kind of what you're seeing?
Yeah, I think it's the lack of upfront capital investment. And I, you know, as I look at rangeland today, if we look at return on investment, not including appreciation, again, I'm not taking into account land appreciation. I'm just looking at free cash flow back to land ownership. It's somewhere on rangeland, probably is between a half and maybe 2% right now. And so when you look at that, if you're trying to make that work financially, if you're trying to buy that land, you better have some other values you're capturing from that land or some other free cash flow from some other business or resource if you're going to be able to make payments. So again, just the return on investment from a free cash flow back to its actual value is pretty challenging to make work right now if you're trying to buy that land and just use income from the forage value it produces to make that work.
What are some of the terms that you see people laying out in their lease agreements that make them a workable solution?
So I think first is, I think we have to see ourselves as being in the service business as we think about leasing land. And so what services can I provide to that landowner? There's really two ways I see land leased. The first is on a what we call a per animal unit basis or per pair month basis, where that's where we pay the landowner based on grazing days per acre as that set fee. And I think that for many folks is what the local market kind of dictates, and that's what they maybe need to do. A better opportunity, or one that I would like to try to see folks do when I've had personal experiences, try to lease that ground on a per acre basis and for a longer term period of time. And, you know, I think sometimes it takes a little bit of time to develop some trust and relationships. So probably not something you can go in initially, but I think over time, what you want to do is try to work to a 3 to 5 or 7 year lease where you have a long-term working arrangement. So you can begin to, with the blessing, of course, of the land ownership, but make some improvements to that land in terms of water development or fence development. Maybe in some places you're dealing with some brush or trees or things like that, but you can begin to improve the productivity of that ground so you're getting greater return to your investment by harvesting additional forage from that with grazing livestock. And then also I think it's when you begin to lease land on a per acre basis, it also gives you the opportunity to participate in some risk management programs like pasture range and forage insurance. And again, I think there's some different thoughts on out there. Should you use that? Should you not use it? I can see different people's perspectives. But if you begin to lease it on a per acre basis, then you have the opportunity to do some things with that. And that also goes the same for some of the programs like range enhancements programs that are available through the NRCS office and things like that. So those are things that I think drive thinking about land leasing. I think obviously some things that I think should be as part of a land lease. First, there ought to be clear terms in terms of what the expectations are, both for you as the person leasing the land, and also from a land ownership perspective, things like when are payments going to occur, if a drought occurs, what's the drought clause, if a fire occurs, who's going to take care of noxious weeds, who's going to be responsible for water development or water replacement if things don't go well. Those are, who's got the liability insurance. Those are all things that I think really should be put in writing. I would say this, that many of the people I work with still do leases on a verbal lease arrangement. And I understand that. I think historically in ag, we have been your word is your bond. And if you can't be trusted, then you won't do business. But I think working, especially as we get more and more land owners who are further removed from ag towards written agreements, and I would see those as, again, it's a written agreement is only good for the people who are involved, but being able to spell out clearly what is going to happen if things don't go according to plan, and obviously sometimes memories get forgotten. And then I would see even on long-term leases, if you go out and make a significant investment, if all you have is the verbal lease and the landlord you're leasing from dies unexpectedly, their heirs have nothing to go on. And so putting leases in writing and having those approved through a lawyer, having them notarized, make sure that both parties are protected in that lease arrangement.
As I look at this idea of leasing land, I kind of see a couple of maybe tangential things, and I'll just put them in these two categories. One of them is connected skills, and the other one is disconnected skills. I think we've already talked on some connected skills relating to grazing and harvesting more forage off of the land with our grazing techniques. Are there any other connected skills? And then I'll just give you a little warning shot here. The disconnected skill to me would be something like economic analysis. Now that's definitely connected to the business, but it's not necessarily connected to the lease itself. And so is there, first we'll start with this connected skills. Are there other skills that we need to have connected to the actual land that will help us to maximize the value we are receiving from that leased land?
I guess for me, I think some of the connected skills is, and I've already kind of touched on this, is really being able to meet the desires or goals of the land ownership. So for some folks, wildlife is a big deal. And if you have some skills and understanding what that ownership is wanting in terms of the environment there that's going to facilitate the type and kind of wildlife they want to see, that's to your advantage. There's parts of Nebraska where we are at and other parts of the United States as well where tree encroachment or brush control is a big part of keeping open space. And so if you have some skills in that or able to manage that, that's to your advantage as well. Another one is that we see increasingly is being able to work with and manage invasive species. And this is one that I think is just going to be increasingly become a challenge for us, especially in the West. How do we deal with rangeland where we have invasive species? How do we do that in a way that is sustainable? What I mean sustainable is I'm not convinced sometimes that herbicide is a real good option. Now, there's some invasives that's part of what we got to do. But, for example, things like cheatgrass or things like that, being able to do some things management-wise to try to preserve the native species that are there from a grazing standpoint and also just understanding management and what you do with management is going to be, I think, some of those connected skills. Go ahead, Clay.
One of the things you mentioned was, brush control and some of those things. And an example that comes to my mind from the High Plains Ranch practicum is Joel Vad at the Maxwell Ranch. I think it was a piece of leased land that we were standing on when he said, if it was up to me, I wouldn't graze it this short, but the landowner wants it grazed down for fire prevention. And that was just an example that came to my mind.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I think is challenging a little bit for us if we're leasing land, because I've leased land, and in your mind, you have a view of how that piece of ground should be managed. But again, if you're going to be effective at leasing land, those who do that well are ones who find out what the goals of ownership are. And sometimes goals of ownership are different than how you would manage it personally if it was yours in terms of ownership.
And I guess we'll finish up this discussion about disconnected skills. Are there other things that we should be getting ourselves prepared to be good at that are not necessarily on the ground issues that we should be paying attention to?
Well, I think increasingly, whether you agree with it or not, I see government interaction with land leasing being part of the deal. What I mean by that is what I see, if you're going to lease land on a per acre basis, you're going to be responsible for dealing with NRCS, reporting acres, things like that. And so that's a skill that you need to develop or be pretty good at, being able to make sure that you're, again, meeting the requirements of those programs. And, you know, I work with some folks who they've enrolled their ground into programs, and the people who are leasing the ground need to report and be accountable to meeting those requirements. And so those would be some of those disconnected skills, I think, that are going to come up. You know, you mentioned economic analysis. I think being able to work with landlords and show them what value you're providing, again, beyond maybe just the check that they're going to get for the lease itself, what value can you bring to them, helping them see opportunities to maybe capture more value from that property than they currently are getting. And finding ways to, again, provide a service that helps them meet their goals.
Let's turn our attention to cowherd leases. You had a November article in the Beef Watch newsletter about leasing cowherds and some of the different things that we need to keep an eye on there. Again, let's start with the why would you want to lease a cowherd? Same reason, right? Upfront investment of capital.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Clay. And, you know, when we go look today, it's less than it was 4 or 5 years ago for sure. But if you're going to go buy a cow herd today, you know, let's say average cow value of $1,300, $1,400, we're looking at 500 cows, that's, you know, $700,000. So that's just not something that folks starting out are going to be able to go leverage in many cases and make that work. So I really see the opportunity to lease cows, the opportunity to lease land. What I would say, you're controlling the asset without owning the asset. And I see asset control in ranching being really one of the skills that is going to be able to separate people out in terms of if you can figure out ways to control the asset without owning the asset, that's going to be to your advantage in many cases financially. So one of the things from a leasing cow perspective I see is there's a lot of folks who have put together this asset over a long period of time, and now they're ready to transition out of some of the day-to-day management. And from an ownership perspective, being able to lease those cows out is a way for them to maintain ownership, disperse of that asset perhaps over a period of time if they should so want, and still be able to be materially participating. There's some tax advantages for that. And it also gives a person who maybe doesn't have the capital to go out and buy cows the opportunity to get in. From a cow ownership perspective, here are some critical things I think you need to think about, think through when you think about leasing cows. And these are really things that drive return back to the ownership of those cows. First is, what's the average cow herd value? And that may sound a little silly, but if you're thinking about return on investment, you have to think about, what's my cow herd value? If I was to go market these cows today, what would be the value of all the cows in the herd? And I think you got to be realistic with yourself here. We've seen some pretty big swings in cow herd value here in the last 5 years. If we were having this conversation in December of 2014, we would be talking about bred cows bringing anywhere from $2,200 to $3,000. Now we're having this conversation today. You can buy bred cows for $1,000 to $1,400 in a lot of places. And so understanding, what's the cow herd value. Second is, I think, what's kind of expected return on investment. What do you expect to get in return on your investment in that cow herd? And here's where I think, again, you got to be realistic. You can get a CD today for around 2% for a short-term CD. Interest rates for operating capital, somewhere around 6%. What's the percent return that you think you should get on investment? And so you, I think as a cow owner, that needs to be clear in your mind on what you think that return on investment should be. The next big driver from return is cow salvage value in terms of what are those cows bringing when they leave the herd. And we're looking at some pretty low cow salvage values as we record this right now. And so that can be pretty challenging as you think about when that cow you own has reached the end of her productive life and leaves the herd, part of your return is that salvage value. That's a pretty low number right now. And this is tied also to what's it cost to get a replacement into the herd. So if you're wanting to maintain ownership of the cow herd, what's it costing you to get a bred replacement in? And then this also ties back to what's the value of that salvage cow when she leaves the herd. And that depreciation and expense has to be taken into account as well. So those are the big things that drive cow lease from a cow ownership perspective. And then I think you have to think about the cow lease in terms of, do you have a cash lease arrangement or do you have a cow cash share arrangement? A cash lease arrangement's pretty clean. There's a guaranteed dollar value that you're going to get back for each bred cow that you started the lease with. And so there's very little risk to the cow owner there. There is some risk. I mean, obviously, cow death loss, things like that. But that's a fairly straightforward, not much, I guess, to debate about. You agree upon a lease value, and that's the amount of money you get. The other is a cow-calf share arrangement. And this one gets to be a little more challenging to identify in terms of what's fair. And so what I really like to do, there's a good resource at the beef.unl.edu website. It's the cow-calf share lease calculator. I've put together a short video on that that people can go and watch. But if you're thinking about a cow-calf share arrangement, I'd really encourage both parties to sit down and work through that cow-calf share lease spreadsheet individually and then together. What this does is allows those parties involved to both put in what they're contributing to the production of weaned calves. And so what that does is allows labor to be included, things like feed, vaccine, equipment expense, ownership cost related to cow ownership for the person who owns the cows. And then we get to a bottom line in terms of what did each party contribute to the production of weaned calves. And the thing I like about that is everyone's situation is different. Some people, they want to own the bulls as well as the cows. For other folks, maybe they're providing some grass as part of that cash lease arrangement. And so it gets to a fair breakout of who contributed what, and then what's the fair percent breakout of the calf crop based on what each party contributed. For the person who's owning the cows, I think you need to just be aware of the trust factor too. Obviously, a share arrangement, you need to trust the person who you're leasing those cows to. And so that's imperative in any business arrangement, but especially in, I think, leasing cows. For the person who's caring for the cows or the operator, you need to make sure that you're being real fair with yourself and with the cow owner in terms of what are you contributing. And if you're providing feed, what's the value of that feed? And again, I think you need to use market value. What's the market value of hay? What's the market value of grass? You need to make sure that you're compensating yourself fairly. And when I say fairly, meaning what the market rate would be for your labor, and also including market rate or value for the equipment you contribute towards the production of weaned calves. So when both parties do that, that's where I think it's best to, or provides the best environment to come up with what a fair share lease arrangement is.
There's the margins are tight in this business, and so is this a long-term solution? Is this a short-term solution? Are these cow share leases generally deals where people are gradually taking over the herd? How does that look? How does that work in your mind?
So I see a lot of different arrangements, Clay. I see some arrangements where the goal is that person who's leasing the cows would eventually take over ownership, and that can be a good workable arrangement. Now, those are often, I see those in family situations where perhaps the older generation is ready to transition out. Perhaps they still own the land. They're bringing in a younger generation, and so part of that transition of ownership is the older generation phases out of the cows over time. As heifers come into the herd, they're owned by the younger generation, and that's a good way to transition. I also see some other arrangements where the person wants to continue to own the cows, and so the land and ownership of the cows are separated, and that person wants to, for various reasons, wants to own cows, and so they want to perpetuate the cow herd. I'll be candid. The cow lease arrangement right now is a pretty tight deal. There's not much left from a net perspective for either the person owning the cows or leasing the cows at this point. Now, saying that, that doesn't mean that it's not something that a person shouldn't do or consider, but in 2014-15, when calves are bringing $1,500, there was some money left both for the owner and the operator there to make that kind of work. If calves are bringing a $900 to $1,000, it's a little more challenging. And so that's, I think, what you got to look at is what works. The other thing I think from a cow ownership perspective, you need to be realistic about what you're getting back in terms of your return. And I think we're going to have some tighter years here short term from a return on investment for cow ownership. If you have a good working relationship with an operator, I realize that you may have to experience a little bit of lean times here to move towards some times when things maybe are a little more lucrative. So I guess that's what I would say. I think from a cow operator standpoint, you need to make sure you pay yourself. I mean, I realize, again, you want to be fair with the person owning the cows, and that's the right thing to do, but you can't work for free. And so being able to make sure you're not going backwards financially long-term and being in that lease arrangement is important as well.
So in both of these instances, you kind of mentioned different arrangements, whether it's a cash lease or it's a per animal unit lease. Is one better than the other in your mind as far as cow lease agreements are concerned?
That's a great question, Clay. So it really comes down to risk. For me personally, if I could afford to do it and I had enough free cash flow, I would rather lease cows on a cash lease arrangement because then I have total control of the weaned calves. I have a lot. It's just a cleaner, simpler situation. That having been said, if cash flow is tight and I'm having to borrow a lot of money from a cow-calf share arrangement, actually might be a more workable situation because then the cow owner is participating in the risk. They're participating in market risk, and that just we're sharing risk. So really, I think what works best really is depending on the people involved, what each party wants, and how that's going to work. And so both arrangements I've seen work well. I've been involved with both kinds of arrangements. So really understanding what both parties want, in my mind, shapes the kind of cow-calf share or lease arrangement you should have.
This is maybe just like a softball question, but is the first lease you find always the best one? Is that always the one you should take, the one that comes across your desk and comes in front of you and comes into your field of view? Is that the one that you should take?
So that's a great question. So I think you have to think about business opportunities in terms of thinking about your whole system and how that piece fits. And I think you have to do some analysis of, does this lease provide some potential or provide some opportunity? Sometimes to just get your foot in the door, you have to maybe take a lease on that wouldn't be your ideal choice. And I'm thinking here primarily of land. Because to get your foot in the door, begin to build a trust and some reputation, maybe you are willing to take on a lease that wouldn't be your first choice. I will say, though, however, if you're putting a pencil to it and you're not able to make it work, then you shouldn't do it. And that's just reality. I think also if I had a lease come across to me as an opportunity and I knew the person on the other end was not trustworthy, that there would be potential problems there, then you probably better let that one go. You know, on cow lease arrangement, I think sometimes if you haven't been leasing cows before, you may not be sure out of the gate how is this going to work, either from an ownership standpoint or from an operator perspective. And so one of the things I encourage people who lease cows, either in a cow-calf share or a cash lease arrangement, is to revisit the lease annually. So the goal is that it would be a longer-term relationship, but we can see some real wide swings in terms of what's happening in the marketplace. Again, I just think about, in my mind, the difference between 2014 and 2016, tremendous wide swings in markets changes. And so an arrangement set up on how things worked in 2014 might have looked pretty good. That same arrangement in the fall of 2016, someone might be feeling pretty left behind. So those are things I think, again, that you should do with a lease arrangement is try to revisit them from a cow-calf share or cash lease fairly frequently up front. And then also, I think from a land lease perspective, until you begin to build some trust, a one-year lease or maybe a two-year lease initially may be important to figure out, can I work with this person? Is this going to be something that we can build to be a long-term arrangement?
Aaron, I appreciate your time today. We'll have links to all the stuff we mentioned today, the article at beef.unl.edu, the cow-calf share lease calculator, and the video you mentioned. All that will be linked at workingcows.net/63. Is there anything we missed today? Anything that you want to, anything else you wanted to say or cover in regards to cow leases and land leases?
So I guess for folks who might be considering entering into a cow-calf share or cash lease arrangement with cows, I'd be happy to be a sounding board or resource. I've worked with a number of folks that have worked through arrangements, and so would be happy to be a sounding board as you're thinking through that. More just bringing maybe some things to think through, some questions to ask, some things to make sure that you have covered as you're thinking about entering into those. And I'm sure Clay will put my contact information on the show notes page as well.
Yep. It'll be there as well as links to Aaron's previous episodes, both of which kind of contribute to our discussion today. One of them on cow depreciation and the other one on economic analysis, both of which came up today in our discussion about, you know, salvage value of cows, replacement rate, average herd value, all those things would come right into cow depreciation and how we manage these lease agreements. So, Aaron, thank you for your time today. Appreciate the Beef Watch podcast and the newsletter as a resource that has continued to help me and my understanding of management and those things. So thank you again.
I appreciate it, Clay.
Really appreciate Aaron and his expertise and just the breadth of knowledge that he has. I encourage you to subscribe to the Beef Watch podcast and the Beef Watch newsletter and keep up with all of his latest articles and all the podcast episodes that he does with other authors of the Beef Watch newsletter. Now, as I was a podcast junkie before I was a podcast host, I listened to a lot of podcasts, and one of the podcasts I listened to was always talking about their Amazon wish list and different gear and books and different things that they had there and people would send them. And so I took that, I followed that lead. And to date, I have been blessed with so much great gear from that Amazon wish list, and there are other pieces up there. And so recently, another podcast I listened to, a podcast about podcasting, as podcasting nerds are wont to do, I listened to this episode, and he asked for a recommendation of gear that you're most thankful for from your cadre of podcasting gear. And so I sent in my list of gear, and here is his response to my response.
Next comes from Working Cows Podcast. He says, gear I am most thankful for. I'll follow your lead with three. Rode Procaster, better than the borrowed mic I was using. Better than the ATR 2100 I would have bought myself. Sent to me from my Amazon wish list by a listener. JK Audio CellTap 4C, such a good tool for getting cell phone conversations into Reaper. Sent to me from my Amazon wish list by a listener. Focusrite Scarlett 2i2 second gen, good clean preamps, plenty of gain to drive the Procaster, sent to me from my Amazon wish list by a listener. Working Cows Podcast, you have some amazing listeners sending you a very expensive microphone. I don't know what that CellTap device is, but that's amazing. And sending you an interface, that is an incredible, incredible fan base. That is just awesome, and those are all very, very good devices. And if I had your audience or an audience member sending me stuff, I wouldn't allow for that because I'm too paranoid to even have a public wish list. but I would be tremendously thankful as well. Very great selections, and I want to send a thank you to your audience as well. Send a thank you from Bander from Podcasting for providing you that gear. That's amazing. Awesome, awesome audience there.
So, yes, I agree wholeheartedly. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much for that. If you want to continue this tradition of giving in this season, Christmas season, you can go ahead and head over to workingcows.net/63, and there will be a list up there, or there will be a link up there to the Amazon wish list, and you can find something. And there's things in every price range that you can imagine of different gear that just are on my wish list. We all got a wish list, right? So there's mine right there at workingcows.net/63, and you can support the show that way. Also, so much appreciate the Patreon supporters, the access that they've gotten to the private Facebook group, and the bonus content, monthly bonus content for the $5 people, and even my first $20 a month supporter, who is going to have some Working Cows swag, stuff we all get. That's what swag means, right? Well, anybody who supports the podcast for more than $20 a month gets some swag sent to them a couple times a year. So really excited to get those produced and put out for everybody to purchase or for Patreon supporters to receive. Coming up next week, I'm really excited to be able to feature a discussion with Tim Goodnight from Faro Cattle Company. We're going to be talking to him about those steers that they slaughtered that were finished on grass and talk about how they graded and all those different things. Sorry, we've been a little bit off schedule. As I said, the flu kind of threw me for a loop. And so we are going to try and get back to the Grassland Coalition episode with the people who are heads of the Mid-Missouri River Prescribed Burn Association. I think I said that right. Richard and Sarah Grimm. We're going to try and get that out at the end of this week as well. So here we go. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you next week with Tim Goodnight from Faro Cattle Company. Until then, Merry Christmas.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.